Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
In modern-day Menhaden fishing, the spotter pilot works together with the crew and equipment of a large refrigerated steamer, which may carry well over a million fish.
A visit to Connecticut's Mystic Seaport makes it easy to understand how important the sea has been to New England's economy, its culture, and its history. Boat-building docks, marinas, and fishing vessels crowd the shoreline, while above the water, along narrow old streets, Greek Revival houses stand tall and fried fish stands cater to townies and tourists alike. The salty smells of the harbor permeate the air. Mystic is one of hundreds of towns on the New England seaboard where the region's past seems somehow closer than it does further inland. For it was from these New England waters that European settlers first spied our land and where boxes of tea would later be dumped in revolutionary protest.
It's here where whaling, shipbuilding, and fishing once dominated the economy, where new cultures, new foods, and new ideas first arrived on our shores, and where some of our greatest writers, from Longfellow to Melville to Eugene O'Neill, found inspiration. Mary Kay Burka Edwards is an associate professor at the University of Connecticut who teaches a Literature of the Sea course in the Williams College Mystic Seaport Maritime Studies program.
New England sea literature has a lot more to do with fishing than other sea literature and about how tough it is there out fishing in the North Atlantic. And of course, the North Atlantic is one of the stormiest of all oceans, and it's not only got storm to contend with, but it also has fog. So you get out there and can get lost in the fog and try and figure out how to get back in it. But usually it was a male world, a world just with nature, and a world where, you know, individual strength and power and will was very important. And so in lots of ways, it's basically a frontier literature, just like literature of the Western frontier, which is what Americans normally think of when they think of frontier literature. But sea literature is completely a literature of the frontier as well.
The influence of the sea on our region's writing goes back as far as the beginning, to 1640 and the Bay Psalms book, the first book written and published entirely in the colonies. Within this book are songs and passages that demonstrate a timeless respect New Englanders have always had for these waters. Today, although the old coastal houses still stand, New England's relationship to the sea has changed.
The whaling fleets have disappeared, and the boat-building industry is long past its heyday. Commercial technology, regulation, and species depletion have made life difficult for the old-fashioned small fishermen. New England's once booming coastal towns have grown accustomed to hard times, while the sea itself has become more of a backdrop than a living, breathing part of community life. Coming up on Storylines New England, we look at our region's relationship to the sea, in our history, in our livelihoods, and in our literature, along with a Rhode Island author's award-winning novel that captures the beauty, the liberty, and the dangers of life on the water. Once again, Mary Kay Burka Edwards.
Literature of the sea has changed, I think, in New England because the world of fishing has changed. At the time when Melville was writing Moby Dick, Melville started to be concerned about the lack of whales and the lessening of the numbers of whales. But it wasn't a real problem. That's only a 20th century problem. And by the time you get into the modern writers, Atlantic groundfish are in terrible straits. And so one of the big problems in literature of the sea now is just the lack of fish and how tough it is to catch enough fish to make a living. And so people are putting themselves out in danger and pushing the envelope. And that is reflected in literature.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of our region as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. So far, we've read from the works of Robert Frost, Mark Twain, and E.B. White, to name a few, and looked at some of the issues these works have raised, from race, class, and economic conflicts in our region's urban areas to the struggles of the family farm. Our goal? To gain a better understanding of where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines, we look to the sea and to John Casey's novel, Spartina.
Few of New England literature's habitual themes are more romantic or more common than our stories of the sea. New England's shoreline stretches across five of its six states, down from rugged, rocky Maine to the sandy and serene inlets of Connecticut and Rhode Island. In between are picture postcard fishing villages, popular summer boardwalks, and 100,000 beaches, bays, and tidal flats. In the first couple of paragraphs of Spartina, John Casey seeks to locate the allure of New England coastal life, not only in its physical beauty, but in the sustenance the ocean still brings to families, businesses, and communities.
Dick Pierce swung the bait barrel off his wharf into his work skiff. He cast off and began to scull down Pierce Creek. He built his skiffs with an oarlock socket on the transom. He had to tell most buyers what it was for. In fact, sculling was a necessity for him. This far up the creek, it was too narrow to row, and except at high water, too shallow to put the outboard down. The tide was still dumping, and he let her drift a bit. A spider's strand broke against his forehead. A light mist came off the water, but dissolved as soon as it got above the black banks. Dick loved the salt marsh. Under the Spartina, there was a black earth richer than any farmland, but useless to farmers on account of the salt. Only the Spartinas thrived in the salt flood, shut themselves against the salt, but drank the water. Smart grass. If he ever got his big boat built, he might just call her Spartina, though he ought to call her after his wife. He always started off these fair early summer days in a mood as calm and bright as the surface of the water. Everything was lit up silver and rose, the dew, the spider's webs, the puffs of mist, even the damp backs of the dunes on the barrier beach that divided the salt ponds, the marsh, and the creeks from the sea.
Dick Pierce is a born and bred Rhode Island fisherman working the Narragansett Bay. He's magnetically drawn to the sea. It's been his passion, his living, and a source of purpose and balance that he can't find in his onshore world. But his irascible demeanor and the late 20th century realities of New England fishing have pushed him into an all but impossible corner. In spite of these failures, Dick Pierce still holds on to a dream, the 50-foot offshore fishing boat he's building, called Spartina. Throughout John Casey's book, we see the price that Dick Pierce is willing to pay to realize this dream, demeaning odd jobs for rich summer people, riding out dangerous storms, even venturing into the illegal domain of the smuggler.
Just in sight of land, Parker told Dick to stop. Okay, here's the deal, small and easy. You and I leave Keith on board. We go in with the skiff once it's dark, get to where the creek goes by Mary Scanlon's parking lot. I go to the parking lot, meet a guy who has a truck. He's been talking to Mary Scanlon about her buying specialty seafood like scongili. Parker used the Italian word for whelks. Parker said, I drop the basket in the back of his truck, get the boat. We come back out a different way than we went in. We meet old Keith here, head back out for a bit. Small and easy, I pay you $5,000. Dick shook his head. Parker said, This is easier than poaching clams. Dick wished he hadn't told Parker about that. Kid stuff, he looked silly, but it still set him up for Parker. You break a little law, you might as well break a big one, Parker said. This is real money. This is half of the rest of your boat.
Life at sea has never been easy. Melville describes the extreme dangers of whaling in Moby Dick, while stories like Kipling's Captain's Courageous lay out the everyday hardships of fishing boat life. John Casey modernizes both the allure and the difficulties. Freedom and self-reliance juxtapose with danger, corporate competition, corruption, and the hard times facing New England's ocean communities. Although it's set in the South County section of Rhode Island, Spartina tells a story also familiar to the old whaling ports of New Bedford and Nantucket, Massachusetts, to the fishing towns of Rockland, Maine and Old Lyme, Connecticut, and to shipbuilding cities like Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Today on Storylines New England, we're looking at our region's long history with the sea, past, present, and future, as we consider John Case's award-winning novel, Spartina, And we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Are you a fisherman, a boat builder, or someone else who makes a living from the sea? Do you live in coastal New England? Are New England's maritime traditions still part of the daily life in your town? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. is John Casey, author of Spartina that we're talking about today. He's a professor of English literature at the University of Virginia. Other Casey novels include The Half-Life of Darkness, An American Romance, and coming out in 2005, a sequel to Spartina. And John Casey, we will faithfully read that book when it comes out. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us from his home in Noank, Connecticut, Stephen Jones, professor of maritime studies at the University of Connecticut. He's also owner of the West Mystic Wooden Boat Company. He's shellfish commissioner for the town of Groton, Connecticut, and author of 9 books. And Stephen Jones, welcome to you, too.
Hello, how are you?
John Casey, I'm going to start with you. Just give us a sense, stepping back for a moment, of just how important the sea was to New England life in the early days, in colonial times, in terms of, you know, our food, our economy, our culture, and our literature.
Well, Steve would know a good deal more about that than I do, but, I mean, that's how both sides of my family got here. That's one thing, and of course, if there was that's how the old families in Massachusetts got rich. All those Crown and Shields and Bradleys and Winthrops and whatnot,
right,
had ships, and they sailed first. I guess there was the Triangle trade. And then later on, they went, to China and the Spice Islands, which was a hugely lucrative trade. I mean, if you got there and got back, you were made.
Right. Well, you said, now that's interesting. You said, John, that both sides of your family got here. Can you tell us that story?
Well, on my father's side, there was a potato blight in Ireland, and so some of the people got off and got here. And on my mother's side, let's see, Thomas Dudley came over in, I think, about 1630, and he decamped there, and that was a fairly prosperous family that went slowly downhill, bumpty 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 bump, until it got to my grandfather, and my grandfather, though, married Ida Louise Åkerblad, a very nice Swede from Vermont. So we've got a mixture of blood there.
You know, Stephen Jones, John is giving us just a sense of how in the early days when New England was being settled by whites, just that the sea was everything to people in this region.
You know, yeah, I was thinking of that, but also, and this takes us right up to John's book, is that most of these people, the exception being the blue water people he was talking about, the coastal people who did the lobstering and the clamming and bottom fishing in these bays and estuaries that you folks are talking about in that passage you read there, they did things beside water work. They were carpenters, particularly in the wintertime. They fixed houses, not only built their own, but fixed houses of those who weren't as skillful at that as they were, and did some farming and so forth. This is much like the old country. And that's still true, I think, that many of your watermen around here even now do other things beside the water, although they're never very far from it. And Dick Pierce's experiments along with that line, you can see that still going on there, and whether it's smuggling, of course, on the darker side. But these other handyman kind of things, because a fellow working on the water needs to have many different talents, you know, to be able to repair things, and whether they're engines or sails or rakes or whatever that is.
So, Stephen, you're saying that's always gone on, that men
who
worked outside the water.
And I think that sometimes the image we have, when Mary Kay was talking about this in your opening, of these deep-water Melvillian types, sure, that was there, and that's the more spectacular thing, and that's what ends up on your wallpaper. you know, and so forth. But I think the majority probably of the work done here was a lot closer to the coast and involved varieties of things, because, you know, the fish change from season to season, mm-hmm. and the with the weather and so forth, and you can't continually, you know, just have one particular species that you chase or one particular maneuver that you endeavor to pull off in order to earn your living. You have to constantly be adapting.
It's kind of a patchwork life, isn't it, Stephen?
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. We have a reading from John Casey's book, Spartina, about the main character, Dick Pierce, who realizes, unhappily, that he's going to have to, well, do a number of these sort of odd, sometimes menial jobs in order to make the money that he needs to build that dream boat, Spartina.
Dick began to see. He couldn't see it all, but he began to get the picture. A lot of the independent lobstermen he knew had made deals with families who had summer houses. They drained the pipes in the fall, fixed the screens in spring. It started that way. Then they'd get a call that the family wanted to spend Christmas at the beach house if they could have the water turned back on, the heat, maybe a load of firewood. And if it wouldn't be too much trouble, get that Eddie what's-his-name to plow the driveway. And if there was a nice pine tree that would do for a Christmas tree, if it wasn't any trouble, just cut it and leave it on the porch. Half the lobstermen Dick knew got a nice Christmas check that way, and another nice check in the spring. He'd swore he'd never do it, but here it was, $500. Dick looked at the quahogs lying in his basket. He looked across the channel to the wedding cake. At least they weren't asking him to drain the pipes.
You're listening to Storylines New England, where we're talking with John Casey and Stephen Jones about John Casey's book Spartina and also about life on the New England coastline. We want to hear from you as well at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. And Stephen Jones, you mentioned that the practice of working on more than just water jobs, so to speak, fishing and other things, is something that came over from England with the first settlers. But I'm curious to know if that way of making a living, that mixed way of making a living, is unique to northern cultures that are by the sea, or if there's anything in particular that is truly and exclusively New England about this kind of water life that John Casey is describing.
Well, I think that down, I have some familiarity with the Chesapeake and Delaware Bay. I spent some time down in the Coast Guard just down there mm-hmm. this spring. Those watermen, too, also do a bunch of different things. I think any of your people that did go out just on day trips, I shouldn't say just in the sense that that's not a big deal, but as opposed to these Melvillian blue water voyages that we're talking about, they all do that. And I was thinking as we're talking here that a lot of people in our village, for instance, I'd say that all of the lobstermen, for instance, either were school teachers or they worked at electric boat building submarines. And they liked to work on the third shift because that got them out at dawn. They could come off work and go right out just as the sun was coming up and pull their pots before somebody else did. And I'm trying to think of anybody I know that doesn't or do that. I'm talking back maybe 40 years in my mm-hmm. personal knowledge of this. And even the guy right over the back, I keep pointing over my shoulder because he lives over the next block, who has, you know, several hundred pots, and is just an incredibly industrious lobsterman. In the wintertime, he plows snow.
Right.
And the thing is, I don't think these people necessarily think that that's demeaning. Now, the fellow in John's book has a particular bug up about some of this stuff, and to be sure, some of the jobs that he's asked to do, like do the clam bake and so forth, he's asked to do them by a particular people in a particular way that does make it seem demeaning. But these guys have their own snowplow company, we'll say, or something like that. Did they have a pride in doing that? And they're you know, a small business owner who's plowing snow or whatever it happens to be. They don't necessarily think that that's a lesser thing to do.
John Casey, is there something in particular about the New England coast, its weather, its conditions, that creates a particular kind of character?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, one thing that's not true is that lobstermen won't talk to you. If you ask them a dumb question, they'll just say no or yeah. Uh-huh. But if you ask them a fairly smart question that shows that you really want to know, they'll go on quite a bit. And I know much less about boats than Steve, but I did live on a small island, 4.2 acres at low tide. And I got to know something about small boats because there was no other way to get to land. And the guys that I met in the boatyard would hold back for a bit, and then they saw that I really needed help, and they still wouldn't give me advice because it's considered rude to give advice unless you're asked. Finally, I would turn around and my face just told the story. I said, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Uh-huh. And a guy would come over and help. And I got to know them that way. And they would stop by the island and tell me their stories. And so a lot of what I got was secondhand. Uh-huh. Although you will notice in the front of Spartina, I thank three people, Lenny Chesney, Roger Chapman, and Steve Jones, mm-hmm. because I didn't do research. But when I got through, I had to make sure that I hadn't said anything really dumb, so I'd go around and ask. and it turned out if you're in the zone, you can guess stuff, and it comes from that part of your mind that's absorbed something, and then it just pops back out. And it turns out to be more or less right. But that thing about giving advice, I did a lot of dumb things the first year I lived on the island, and finally people would come down and say, you know, you don't want to do that.
John, what were you doing on the island? What was your reason for being there?
I'd always wanted to live on an island, and I thought that I knew something about small boats when I moved there, but boy, did I have a lot more to learn. And the first year was very tough, and then the second, the third, and the fourth year got better, and just when I got really good at it, because you have to do everything yourself. I mean, if the well doesn't work, you've got to climb down in the well and replace the foot valve. And if the outboard doesn't work, I mean, there was one time that I was rowing a skiff into the harbor. I was about 2.5 miles, and the outboard, which didn't work, was in the stern sheets on a pillow, and about halfway to town, I thought, wait. Man is slave to his machine here. Mm-hmm. So it was little stuff like that, and some of the stuff that Dick Pierce gets up to, I would hear from people. I had a few lobster pots out myself. Strange things show up in lobster pots, by the way. You get whelks, you get eels occasionally. You'll get tautog, which down south is called a blackfish.
You know, I spent actually a large part of my childhood on coastal New England, and I mean really coastal. I mean, we had, you know, during storms, we would have spraying up on our windows.
We
were right on it. And I know what shows up in lobster pots because we had some too. You pull it up and it's heavy and you go, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be great. You know, you're picturing your lobster dinner and then you get an old boot that somehow walked its way into the pot. But both of you, and I'll start with you, John Casey, you know, the coast of New England is difficult. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a pristine, beautiful crystal beach. It's difficult. The Atlantic has a lot of storms. There's a reason it's not called the Pacific, in other words, peaceful.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's a tough, tough ocean to work in. And I wonder, and I'll turn to you first, John, and then Stephen, just how that affects the people and the culture along the coast of New England.
Well, I could refer you to three different books that could fully answer that in a lot better way. One, of course, is The Perfect Storm,
right,
which has a terribly unhappy ending. The other is The Hungry Sea by Linda Greenlaw, where it's just the day-to-day work. And the other is an interesting book called Against the Tide by Richard Adams Carey, which is a fact book about four different people. I think one is a lobsterman, another pulls up quahogs, another's a long liner, and I can't remember the rest. And their difficulties are very clearly outlined there. And it's weather, It's days you can fish that are allowed by the new regs, and it's not having enough money, and it's also the kind of toll it takes on family life. So and you've got to be pretty tough, both physically and psychically.
Right.
Steve has spent a lot of time at more time at sea.
Yeah.
Than I have.
Steve, your thoughts on that too? Again, this tough coastline and how it affects people in terms of their psychology and their culture.
I'm looking out the window right now at Latimer Light blinking, which is right in the corner of Fishers Island Sound, which is Fishers Island is New York, Rhode Island is just right out to the left of that, and I'm standing in Connecticut where all the street come together. And there are 9 lighthouses that you can see, not quite from the kitchen here, but from the hill up back of me. And that tells you that there's a lot of menaces out there, that people decided that they'd have to build 9 lighthouses. One doesn't build a lighthouse, you know, casually.
Right,
not
right.
Like setting a buoy or something. It also tells you that there's a lot of in and outs and estuaries and sandbars. All of these make it very rich in the terms of the ecosystem and so forth. So what you get with one hand gets taken away by the other. Well, I think I wanted to say about John's book in terms of the sensibility, which we're sort of dancing along the edge here when you're talking about what Pierce, you know, how he is able to deal with these people and his attitudes towards whether something is menial or degrading or not. What I think he's done here is he's captured this New England sensibility. John's book goes right down on the kind of knife edge, like one of those fillet knives you see stuck in the ring on the mast there on the fishing boats, you know. It just comes right down that knife edge between that sort of rancorous, bitter, swamp Yankee resentment on the one hand and a kind of dry Yankee ingenuity on the other, where, you know, we applaud these people because they're able to make do with all kinds of stuff, you know, in all kinds of weather, as we were talking about. And Pierce seems to be walking that very fine line. I mean, sometimes you want to throw the book at the wall because he's being so stubborn.
So true.
I just reread this the other night, and other times you say, yeah, oh, yeah, there, now he's got it. But you can feel that anger surging up as you read it, because you can see, you know, the kind of frustrations of the people that come in from away, as we say, you know, with the sort of easy answers to things. And the character Parker there, for instance, who's I think it's interesting the way that John sort of plows through his mind, the minds of his characters, the kind of eco-metaphors here with the Spartina, the passage that you read at the opening, but all through there, and the landscape and the weather have become part of the way, I guess we'd say cognitively, you know, his characters think. And Pierce has this kind of ecological vision of how everything kind of works together, and the people coming in don't. They sort of try to superimpose kind of vision from somewhere else or from
magazine. And we're definitely going to talk about that after a short break, about insiders versus outsiders, people moving into small coastal towns and their impact, and more on New England's maritime traditions and history, and of course more on John Casey's book Spartina. Your calls to 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org.
And as we begin to wrap up our series, we want your feedback, your thoughts, what you liked, and if you'd want to hear more of this program in the future.
You can send your comments or your feedback in an email to publicprograms, that's all one word, at ala.org. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Come on and lift and tow that line, set your sails and bide your time. It's family and a life of ease for me. Come on.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
There's no other place I'd rather be. Yes, there's no other place I'd rather be.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand ourselves as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today, we're reading from John Casey's 1989 novel, Spartina, and looking at New England's long history with the sea, from the whaling and fishing industries that have strengthened our economies to the touristy towns and ragged coasts that have defined our land and our character, to the writers, from Emerson to Celia Thaxter to Sebastian Younger, who have found inspiration on our waters.
Spartina tells the story of a man, his boat, a storm, and his ongoing struggle to find himself on the open seas, themes very familiar in our region's literature. Dick Pierce's a salt-of-the-earth Rhode Island fisherman who has always had trouble with authority. He dreams of building a boat of his own, of making an independent living on the water. Spartina shows, for better or worse, how our region's relationship with the sea has changed. Long gone is the heyday of New England's coastal towns, where fish provided a major food source, whaling expeditions promised riches, and shipbuilding was an economic backbone.
Yet the small town of Mystic in southeastern Connecticut is holding on to its maritime roots. The town still has the feel, the sights, and the smells that leave no doubt of the ocean's primary importance in daily life. And its most famous institution identifies itself as the Museum of America and the Sea. Storyline's producer Keith Shields visited Mystic Seaport to learn more about our region's relationship with the ocean, from our literature to our industry to how the sea has formed the New England character.
My name is William Peterson, and I'm the senior curator at Mystic Seaport. If you were to ask somebody from, I don't know where, Wyoming, what picture they have of New England, maybe one of the first things that would come to their mind would be fall foliage, but I think a very close second would certainly be a Gloucester fisherman in his sou'wester, or images of whaling and shipbuilding. I think there's an individualism, certainly in the character of New England's fishermen, whether it's Maine lobsterman or whether it's Stonington, Connecticut scalloper. I think that they would all agree that the individuality that the life of a fisherman allows them is very important to them, and I think people see that from outside the activity, locally as well as across the nation.
My name is Quentin Snedeker, and I'm the director of the Preservation Shipyard at Mystic Seaport. In earlier times, colonial times, the 19th century, shipbuilding was such an integral part of many communities, whereas further south along the coast, it didn't tend to dominate as an industry. It was peripheral, but here in New England, it was almost generic. Any place that had deep enough water and was convenient to shipbuilding timber could be used as a shipbuilding site, and it was sort of that widespread. Right now, I'm sure that within a few miles offshore of where we're located, there are tugboats moving cargoes of oil, there are containers moving in and out. So our lives still depend on the sea, but it's not as visible to us. You know, you go to Walmart, most of the products that are in there came firm containers from the Orient, you know, right to this very location. So it's still an integral part of our lives, but not as visible and not as much on the consciousness as it would have been in earlier times.
My name is Mary Kay Burka Edwards. I teach Literature of the Sea for the Williams College Mystic Seaport Maritime Studies Program. I'm also an associate professor in residence at the University of Connecticut, which has a brand new Maritime Studies Program. One of the major themes of Literature of the Sea is humans against nature. And when you think about it, especially the Romantic poets were interested in the sublime, which is nature at its like most sublime, its most overpowering and most beautiful. And of course, we usually associate Romantic poets with things like the Alps. But when you think about it, the ocean is nature at its most sublime. Completely. It's the largest thing on Earth. It covers 3/4 of the Earth. And it's just overpowering, and it's also magnificently beautiful. So Literature of the Sea often works with the idea of humans in the midst of this world. It's changed in the 21st century. Fewer people make their living with fishing, but that kind of early relationship to the sea, I think, has helped to define the character. You know, the intense kind of relationship with weather and the rugged conditions and how to stand the cold, all those things that come from the original relationship with the sea.
In order to successfully go to sea, one must have a certain boldness, a certain spirit of entrepreneurship, risk-taking, and I think that especially going to ships under sail, you know, before modern conveniences, modern power, that entrepreneurship, that courage and tenacity really helped define the New England character. Bringing the knowledge of foreign places back has also shaped the culture in that it's made us more worldly in our view, a generally more accepting, more diverse character, a greater respect for other cultures that tends to characterize the New England consciousness today.
Today on Storylines New England, we are looking at our region's long history with the sea, past, present, and future, as we consider John Casey's award-winning novel, Spartina. And we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Do you fish for a living? Are you a boat builder or someone else who makes his living on the water? Do you live in coastal New England, even though you don't work on the ocean? Are New England's maritime traditions still part of the daily life of your town? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us from a studio in D.C. is John Casey, author of Spartina and a professor of English literature at the University of Virginia. Other novels include The Half-Life of Darkness and American Romance, and we have found out today that coming out in 2005, there will be a sequel to Spartina. Joining us from his home in Noank, Connecticut, Stephen Jones, professor of maritime studies at the University of Connecticut and owner of the West Mystic Wooden Boat Company. He's also shellfish commissioner for the town of Groton, Connecticut. He's author of 9 books. Again, we want your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477.
John Casey, one of the intriguing things about this terrific novel is your very delicate and yet also extremely complicated picture of the relationships between people who have always lived on the ocean or who have made their living from the ocean and people who are, for want of a better word, from another kind of class, one that's perhaps a bit more privileged, one that finds the ocean something of an adornment or backdrop to lives that are not necessarily dependent on it. I'd like to hear you talk about how you went about sketching out this relationship between people, because, of course, in your work, unlike many other books about New England, this relationship is not a black and white one.
Well, no, and in a very small state, you get lots of different classes and lots of different backgrounds, and at one point, I thought during the fiction that I was going to set in Rhode Island, I would make an effort to get every ethnic group in. Well, there just isn't room.
Right.
So I've got Yankee, both upper class and swamp Yankee, and Italians, and Portuguese, and then towards the end, Vietnamese as they move in a bit. And I should add one thing here is that the food certainly got better after the Italians and the Portuguese arrived.
Vietnamese food isn't too bad either.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that too. Yeah, that's right. Because among other things, they would eat. They showed us how to eat things that we hadn't eaten before, and that could be room for a whole other half hour or hour.
You bet.
But now to get back to the class question, there are people who've lived there for a long time, like Miss Perry, who is very sympathetic to Dick and feels a kind of kinship to him, although she's from another class.
There's a bit of noblesse oblige there too, isn't there?
There is, and she's not a perfect woman. Although I like her a whole lot. Actually, I like them all a whole lot, except Parker.
that's pretty obvious, John.
And there are a couple of others who are a little bit. But it is true that one of the things that fuels Dick's anger is that he knows a lot of stuff. And the stuff that he knows about going to sea, I mean, it's not. I mean, he can build a small boat, and he knows you know small boat stuff, and he knows enough to use a Loran and the radio and the computer and just tons of stuff, but he's not getting paid a whole lot for it. And the people who have made their money some other way, say on Wall Street, arrive and they buy a huge, you know, a huge yacht, and then they make pets of these fishermen who know how to go to sea.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, they kind of admire them, but on the other hand, then, you know, Labor Day comes and these guys are gone. But there's a push-pull in there. And one of the other people I'm not crazy about is the documentary filmmaker, who's a wise ass. And one of the things that distinguishes him from some of the other sort of rich people who own sailboats is that he doesn't give a damn about the sea, which puts him in a slightly different area there. And he can look with a completely, kind of cynical eye, at the whole thing. But not many people will talk overtly about class, but it does still exist, certainly in Rhode Island. Although I haven't actually lived there for quite a while, but I spent enough time there to sort of absorb that.
Well, John Casey and Stephen Jones, let's go to the phones. We have a lot of people who want to talk to you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number here on Storylines New England. And to East Corinth, Vermont first. And Bill is calling us. Bill, you're pretty far from the coast, huh?
Well, I guess I am. Sitting here on the eastern side of Vermont, at least.
Uh-huh.
But I am from Orleans, Cape Cod, and I fish out of the port of Chatham.
Uh-huh.
And John was mentioning, by the way, hello, John. I intend to read your book now that I'm listening to you on the radio.
Oh, great, thanks.
John was mentioning a book about fishermen from Chatham, Orleans, the area on the Outer Cape that was the one called Against the Tide. And I happen to be one of the fishermen that's in that book.
So really? I'll be darned. I'm
the dragger owner. You were right, there were four individuals, and Mr. Carey stayed with Brian Gibbons for a number of months that summer in preparation for the writing of that book. Brian was really the star of the story. He's a local lobsterman. Unfortunately, he died two summers ago, and we miss him tremendously on the Cape.
Sorry to hear that.
To talk about some of the things you mentioned, in terms of the regulations, I guess actually the reason I'm even here on the Cape, or away from the Cape, is we just don't have the time anymore to go to sea and make a living under the new regime of controls. And I think anybody that fishes commercially or otherwise knows that there needed to be some controls put in place, but the extent to which we're functioning now is working people on the water has really been controlled.
Bill, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually want Stephen Jones to comment on this first, but I'll turn to you, Bill. What's the sense among small New England fishermen like yourself about the future? The reading that I do just gives me this sense of doom that, you know, it's just getting worse and worse and you're just not going to make it. Is that an exaggeration?
Well, that up to this point, I'd say that's very accurate. We were wondering whether we would make it, and most people are still hanging on, but you wouldn't believe the number of people who are no longer in the industry, the number of boats that are gone. The old ways are certainly dead. I mean, somebody said a minute ago in your discussion about the old days of tearing out to sea and doing what you did, basically being an entrepreneur, and as hard as you worked was as well as you did. If you were smart and you worked hard, you did very well. Those days are definitely behind us. The level of regulation today, we literally have vessel monitoring systems which transfer our location to the fishery service no matter where we go, around the clock if we are out on the sea. The lay people in the world, in the country, just would not understand at all what we go through. The sense of doom, though, to answer your question, I don't think that many of us really feel at this point, because we've gotten this far through the greatest level of change, that if we're still here, we're probably going to stay here.
Mm.
And that's how I feel about it. I'm going to continue to work. My son and I own the boat together. It's a 50-foot fishing boat. We catch reasonably good catches. We make a reasonably good living for the time that we're out on the water.
Well, Bill, I want to get Stephen Jones' thoughts, too, and it's great to hear from you, as a fisherman in this area. Stephen Jones, what do you think, the sense among New England fishermen, small New England fishermen like Bill today?
Well, I'm pleased to hear that he's still optimistic about things. It used to be that there's a kind of built-in ecological alarm that went off, and it worked economically that when you got down to a certain level in the stock, it became no more economically possible for you to continue doing that. No one told you had to stop. It just wasn't worth making that trip, setting that net, risking the price of losing it, and so forth. when you only got a certain amount. And at that point, you see, those fish were stopped, the people stopped fishing for those, and that. But there was a still a kind of bank, you might say, laid away there, and so that your stock could rebound. But nowadays, the equipment is so sophisticated that we never quite get to that point, and the fear always is that, you know, just take it right down to there's nothing there. That is the sort of excuse, I guess, behind a lot of these regulations. But I agree with Captain Bill that the kind of thing that often happens, I think the law of unintended consequence was invented, or the concept anyway, for talking about fisheries regulation, because I can't think of better examples than what happens, you know, unintendedly by some of these well-meaning laws, by well-meaning people. It's enough to drive you to a weeping despair or to move even further inland than Bill has done.
It's been a continuing story in the New England fishery, hasn't it, for quite some time now. Well, you're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner, along with Laura Canoy. Today, as you're hearing, we are talking about that primal presence in New England life, the sea, and we're talking with John Casey, author of the National Book Award-winning novel, Spartina, and with Stephen Jones, a professor of maritime studies. But we need to go to the phones. We have a lot of calls waiting for us, so let's take another one. And this is Don from Linden Center, Vermont. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Thank you. I feel like the proverbial sailor who threw an oar over his shoulder and walked inland until somebody said, "What's that?"
Oh, a Greek reference.
Tiresias and Odysseus.
Mm-hmm. This is after spending many years on Narragansett Bay. What always impressed me about talking to people who had lived and worked and sailed on the sea was, particularly in New England, Newfoundland, and going on up the coast into Canada, the primary formative effect seemed to come from the fact that these people were always working on the coast. When you go to sea, there are two times when it is really, really dangerous. That's when you are leaving, when you are coming in. When you get out to sea, there are days when absolutely nothing happens, regardless of the tales of the perfect storm, et cetera, and so on. But the book that really made the biggest impression on me was Farley Mowat's Gray Seas Under, which is the tale of salvage tugs who worked during World War II, before World War II, and through World War II, and after World War II. And they were always working along the coast. And the emphasis was that they became intimately familiar with the coast, but never foolishly familiar with it.
Well, Don, what is the major thrust of what you're trying to say today?
These people are working in under very, very difficult conditions, whether
yeah.
they be fishermen, whether they sail commercially or whatever. They are always working close to the coast, and that is the most dangerous part of everything. And if that is not a character former,
right.
I don't know what is.
You know, and I'm so glad you talked about, you know, working close to the coast and the landscape forming a character, because this is something that you, John Casey, get into very nicely in Spartina. We want to play a reading from the book where it's after the lead woman character, Elsie, the woman that Dick has an affair with. She criticizes herself uncharacteristically. She's sort of a cheerful woman. And Dick sort of is musing on the odd juxtapositions that you find in New England's coastal landscape, sort of how the landscape affects people.
Everything in her could go either way. For all her quick nerve, she still wasn't sure she'd absorbed enough good from doing a job, from living here, from wanting to be rooted in this heap of hills, rock-bound ponds, scrub woods, creased with streams running down to the salt marsh. All this tag end of a glacier, half tumble down in useless disorder, half a fertile accident for ingenious, stubborn little forms of life accommodating to the old wreck and spill of a rock, on and on to the way it was now, still half a disaster, half a wonder. Here it was again, tumbled down and flooded, And here they all were, plants and animals, at it again in the old accident.
And you're listening to Storylines New England, where we're talking with author John Casey and maritime professor Stephen Jones. And John Casey, that little section that we just read is a wonderful example of the kind of meditative prose that fills Spartina. In the case of your central character, Dick, you know, in so many ways, this is among the most New England of the books that we've read during this Storylines series, not least because Dick Pierce, your central character, is so concerned with his own opinion of his moral standing in the world. This is such a New England thing. And yet he has a kind of selectivity about what he rewards and what he punishes himself for on a moral basis. It seems to be perfectly all right, or, well, not perfectly all right, but it seems to be admissible for him to, say, have an affair, to smuggle drugs. And yet other things bother him terribly, such as the need to borrow money. Tell us a little bit about the particular qualities of New England moral character that you tried to capture in Dick Pierce.
Well, I'm not sure that he's perfectly comfortable with his affair. Certainly,
no, you're
not
absolutely
as,
right.
Certainly not as comfortable as she is. and the smuggling thing, I would say, I think that he thinks of it as no harm, no foul.
I mean,
I don't. But I can see how he would get to that view. Mm-hmm. So I think he's very strict about. One of the Puritan senses that has come down to us is you know, come labor on, who dares stand idle on the harvest plain? Well, all around him waves the golden grain. That's an old hymn that used to be sung, and so that if you work, you should get something for it, and if you don't work, you're an idler, and that seems to me to be even higher than godliness or cleanliness on the New England scale of virtues, and it's something I admire myself, and I find it creeping up on me. If I don't do something during the day, I feel terrible.
Yeah, and it's very New England.
Yeah,
we all feel that way.
Good. I guess it's good, although it'd be nice to relax and have a good time once in a while, too.
You know, Stephen Jones, I wanted to ask you about that reading that we just played that, again, sort of juxtaposed, you know, the landscape of sort of a harsh, barren, rocky coast with an incredible fertility of the sea. And there's just this sort of yin and yang, you know, in that description of the New England landscape, isn't there?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite passages, and I'm pleased that you had your fellow read that one. It goes back, I think, to the sensibility here, the Puritan sensibility, but with a kind of modern turn to it. You know, the first part of the book seems to me a struggle between what's funny and what isn't. I mean, this is one of the things that makes Pierce really angry. He feels that you shouldn't laugh or be amused at things. If you can't afford to be amused by it, in other words, the people coming in can afford to make jokes and laugh and take things lightheartedly, whereas he can't. I think that's a very New England thing, and it's very different, I think, than John was talking about his roots back in the potato famine, which are the same roots that I have. And I think if our ancestors had to wait before we could afford to make a joke,
yeah,
you wouldn't make
who
one.
Who has
yet.
Time to joke?
Yeah, and I think you can say that for a lot of European groups, the Russians and. And so many of them, you know, Italians and so forth, from the great comic traditions, nobody was waiting for to be able to afford. You know, the joke was always on our own poverty, and we didn't have to arrive at a certain level before we could crack that smile. And that's a very New England thing, and he's got it perfectly with Pierce. I think that's one of the things that make me angry at Pierce, but I also appreciate that John has got him right in so doing that, yeah.
Well, I think that this portrait of this particular character in his time and place is one of the most effective ones we've seen in recent literature, even though we have a kind of unspoken rule on this show that we don't praise too much. But Stephen Jones, you've given me a perfect lead-in for this one last question to you, which is, Where do you place the novel Spartina in this long, rich tradition of New England literature of the sea?
Well, without making a ranking of it, I think it does something that none of the other books do. I've read since she came out, I'm referring to her as a boat almost. And of course, the boat's named Spartina. About New England fishermen and so forth, I won't bother naming what it is, but I think that this book is unique in that it does the kind of stuff that we've been talking about here in a way that none of the others do. It's sort of, here's an odd thing, maybe Ethan Frome, you know, but updated, which is a book about the inland, but by Edith Wharton, Ethan Frome, but it's very definitely a similar sort of sensibility, and particularly in the male-female relationship, but John's got it down here for this part of the spectrum of time in which we live.
It's certainly a little less depressing than Ethan Frome
That's right, don't you think? You know, there's a great thing, I think, that sums up the Yankee character. When you get a good day in spring after a hard winter, and the weather's maybe it's about 42 or something, and maybe you got a little southwest wind, so it's not too bad, and you see the guys down at the post office, and you say, nice day, isn't it? And they'll say, we'll pay for it.
I understand that. Hey, one last quick question for you, John Casey. We talked about, you know, where Spartina fits in this literary tradition. As you were writing the book, did you have the ghost of, you know, Melville over your shoulder and Moby Dick? And was it an intimidating process to be joining this tradition?
Believe me, if I had had the ghost of Melville anywhere near, I would have been too spooked to keep writing. No, and Steve knows this. Steve has written a lot. When you're writing the book, you're in the book, and you're not thinking of reviews. You're not thinking of the audience. You're thinking of, you know, is this going on in some truthful way? And you can feel when it is, and you can feel when it isn't. So thank God you don't have time to look around to see who's, you know,
on your shoulder.
Well, Satchel Paige had it right, actually.
Well, John Casey, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
John Casey, author of Spartina, and Stephen Jones, good to have you too. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Jones is a maritime studies professor at the University of Connecticut.
For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, go to our website at storylines.ala.org.
Also, as we begin to wrap up this series, we want your feedback, your thoughts, what you liked. If you're interested in hearing more of this program in the future, send your comments by email to publicprograms, that's all one word, at ala.org.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help today from Dan Colgan, Kate McNally, and Rebecca Kaufman. Pat Tierney performed our readings.
Library discussion guides written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates participating libraries. The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Zalis.
Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, faith, belief, and healing through the pages of John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany.
In our final installment, we look at the role religion and faith have played in our region and in a book by a New Hampshire author that explores miracles, hope, and the powers of belief.
John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany on the next Storylines New England.